last week in our study of Romans chapter 7, which is a particularly challenging chapter, simply because it deals with issues that most of us haven't given much thought to, most of us not most of us in this room, but most of us as professing Christians in Christianity. Most of chapter 7 is not well explained. That's why we're plodding our way through trying to figure out what did Paul mean by the things he said. And in our concluding study last week of the first paragraph in chapter 7, we looked at verses 5 and 6, the former condition that we were in when we were dominated by law and the productions of our bodies were in the direction of death, so that our members were being used by spirit of disbelief and the fear and all of those internal conflicts that are generated by that. And out of that came a downward death spiral. But the alternative in verse 6 is that we have been, as believers, removed so far from the law that the scriptures presented as being destroyed from the law. So the law has absolutely nothing to say to us because we died to the thing that we were bound in and we serve in newness of spirit, the provision that God has made for a new kind of life. But it's obvious in our culture and it's obvious in our interactions with people that living by the Spirit is not a widely done thing. There are far more contradictions to biblical living than there are examples of it. But that's always been the case. There were only 8 people in the days of the flood. There were only 2 people who went into the land. And it's always been about a small group of people who say, okay, this is the truth. This is the way we're going to function by faith in it. And we just want to be part of that small group. So we looked at the contrast of what we were like, what we currently have as an opportunity, serving in newness of spirit. But we also saw a statement that Paul made that the sinful passions were through the law. The New American Standard says they were aroused by the law, but that's really not exactly right. He says the sinful passions were through the law, and they were at work in the members of our body. And that's the reason why we have verse 7 and the question that's raised. Because in the issue of the law being useful to sin to produce behavior that leads us to death, and all of that attached in some way to the idea that the law of God is the tool that sin is using to do that, it raises a significant question, and that question is, in verse 7, what should we say then? Is the law sin? Or we could say, is the law sinful? Is there a major flaw in the law that actually makes it sinful? And the reason that question is raised is simply because of verse 5, where Paul assigned the sinful passions to the instrumentality of law. And he did it again in 1 Corinthians 15, where he said, the sting of sin is death, and the strength of sin is the law. So he wasn't bashful about putting the law in that mix, but he knew as soon as he did it that there would be some who would then become antinomian. They would be totally against law because there's a problem here. And he didn't want that, because that's what's at the root of verse 7. So I want us to think our way through verse 7, and I want us to think of it in light of the way he said this. He says, what shall we say then? This is really the first issue. Anytime we are confronted with any kind of declaration that is considered to be true, if we yield to it, we will then become dominated by it. We will yield our members to it, and we will be producing behavior out of it because it's true. In our minds, it's true. The biggest problem there is it might not be. So we do have this truth thing that has to be there. And in verse 7, when he says, what shall we say then? He is saying that the first principle is you got to draw definitive conclusions along the way. In other words, when you run into something that's declared to be a fact, then you can't put that fact on hold and say, well, I'm not going to deal with that, and then go on, because you can't go on. There is this biblical principle in the scriptures that things are built line upon line, precept upon precept. And we see this in many of the academic disciplines where you have to learn certain things first because you can't go any further if you don't. Math is the easiest illustration of that because math is not a natural thing that we just assimilate. You could use language, but language is a more difficult illustration simply because we grow up assimilating language from the very time we were first born. People are saying things to us, and they're expecting us to start understanding them at some point along the line, and they're so thrilled when we utter our first evidence of language, and then they laugh at us when we say things in words that are funny or whatever. And so the language thing, it's really line upon line, precept upon precept, but it's not as easy to use as an illustration simply because there is this constant immersion. But math is not like that. You're not just constantly immersed with math. So in a mathematical illustration, if you don't learn 1 plus 1 equals 2, you can't possibly talk about the tangent of whatever that is infinity. You can't. I mean, there's no way. So there's this issue that Paul raises in verse 7, the opening statement, when he says, what shall we say then? He is saying, how should we view the law? What conclusion should we draw? And the very fact that he says then means that he's talking about something that has already been said. And I've already pointed out that what has been said is that the sinful passions, which were in our flesh, were through law. The whole idea there is that there's got to be something wrong with the law if, in fact, the sinful passions that were in us in the flesh got their impetus or got prodded by law to produce this behavior. And when he says then, he simply means we've got to keep in mind what he just said. And then we have to draw a conclusion. And so this is the issue. What shall we say means we are required to draw conclusions from what we're being told so that we can move to the next thing. We pointed out a couple of times already that Romans 6, 7, and 8 have three major themes. Chapter 6 is grace, chapter 7 is law, chapter 8 is locked by the Spirit. And I'll guarantee you, if you don't get grace and law down, you're never going to get life by the Spirit down. It ain't going to happen. Because legalism, living by law, under false perceptions of grace, is the default position of humanity. And you don't get over default positions just by ignoring them. You only get over them by climbing over the hump and working your way through whatever. And so that's what Paul is actually insisting to be done. There is the same thing in chapter 6, verse 1. After establishing the issue of the substitutionary issues of chapter 5, where in Adam this is the truth and in Christ that's the truth, he says, what shall we say then? Well, he's back to that question. What shall we say then? What kind of conclusion do we have to draw here? And we have to draw them on the basis of what we've been told. And that's the only way we can move forward in understanding. And as long as we keep ourselves aloof from drawing the conclusions that have to be drawn, we are keeping ourselves from being able to understand, and that means we're keeping ourselves from being able to function by faith. Because faith requires that we have some sort of understanding, and that kind of understanding comes only as a consequence of moving through the line upon line, precept upon precept process. And you can only do that by drawing conclusions along the way. As a thing is established as true, you've got to conclude something about that so that you can move to the next thing. So, if we really are serious about living by faith, we're going to have to draw some conclusions based on what we've been told, and that's the issue of verse 7, opening thing. There is a significant issue in drawing conclusions, and I can say this about that. It's the most dangerous phase of the development of our thinking from this point to this point to this point to this point. Going back to the math thing, if we get it fixed in our head that 1 plus 1 equals 3, from then on we're in trouble. If we conclude that 1 plus 1 equals 3, if that's the conclusion we draw and we start to build the next step on that, everything from that step forward is going to be skewed by the false reality. The thing that we claim to be convinced is true is not true. And so drawing conclusions is the most dangerous phase of the development of the way we're going to live. Because as soon as we draw a false conclusion, it skews everything from then on. And life's complicated, so it's really easy to be subjected to all kinds of things and then draw conclusions that are not. I think this is the reason why you have as much goofed up thinking as you have in every mind that's on the planet. Even if we think we have a grasp of something biblical, we have to understand that we may have a legitimate grasp of that biblical thing, but there are going to be a lot of other things that we do not grasp that well. And as a consequence, even our life by the facts of the truth will be shadowed by living by things that are not true and that overshadow sometimes the truth. And people call us hypocrites because we're not perfect. We don't apply this truth universally across the board because we don't even know how. And as a consequence, our lives are less than they should be, and people draw conclusions, false conclusions from that. They accuse the foundations of our thought to be false, when that's not the issue at all. The issue is our ignorance and the confusion of multiple levels of complication. But even though it's dangerous, we still have to do it. And the question, what shall we say then, strongly implies that we might draw a false conclusion. And so he suggests a false conclusion. Is the fact that verse 5 says that the sinful passions are through the law, does that mean then that there's a flaw in the law, that there's a problem, that law is significantly twisted so that it's actually sinful? It's not everything it ought to be. Well, the big answer to that is going to come in this paragraph, and we're not going to get into the big answer because it's in the next verses. The point, however, is that the question is raised by sin's use of law to produce the offspring in the union between the old man and the in us in production of sinful behavior. Is the law at fault in that? Is there a problem there? And so the first principle is we have to draw the conclusion. Second one is we have to clarify exactly what we mean by that conclusion. Paul taught that the conflicts of the sins that arise because our bodies have agendas, our souls have agendas, our spirits have agendas, and there are many, many occasions when those agendas are mutually exclusive, and somebody has to call the shot and say, okay, in this mutually exclusive situation, you're going to get sacrificed and you're going to get satisfied. And in the next situation, you may get denied and you may get satisfied. This depends on how it's all going to work. Somebody has to draw that definitive line in the setting where there are mutually exclusive things. So if your body's in danger of physical death and your spirit's in danger of being proved to be a coward if you run from this death thing, there's an agenda issue there that's in direct contradiction. You can't be brave and save your body. Or you can save your body and be a coward. But you can't be both. So somebody's got to decide how that's going to fly. And Paul says that's the issue that we're facing. We have to clarify exactly what we're expecting from this question of the sinfulness of law. Because these conflicts are set up in a very real sense because of the presence of law. The issue through law in verse 5 is also used in verse 7 when he says, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. It's exactly the same grammatical construct, through the law. It's the issue of instrumentality. And the particular form is the subject of much of the remainder of this chapter, but the issue is instrumentality, and that's the reason that Paul's insisting that we draw a conclusion. What is the law's intent on God's side on giving it? What was his intention as an instrument? And how did that instrumentality then get turned into an instrument of death being used by sin? Well, the answer to that is really in verse 8, but we're not even going there yet. Tonight we won't get there. The point, though, is that we have to draw a conclusion about this instrumentality thing, and that means that there has to be an answer to the question, is there an inherent evil characteristic in law that serves sin as the tool for producing evil? And yet, as is, I think, always the case, it's not the instrument that possesses the attributes of the one who wields the instrument. In other words, if I go out here and get on a backhoe to dig a ditch, if I'm a hot-tempered, short-tempered, whatever, my getting on that backhoe, cranking up the motor and putting my hands on the levers to operate it, does not communicate short-temperedness to the backhoe. Now, in my short-temperedness, I may make that backhoe do some things that a normal person wouldn't do if they weren't angry. But it's not the instrument that's the problem. It's the wielder of the instrument. And that's one of the things in our culture that has been constantly debated, because there is a whole section of our culture that says we need to get guns out of people's hands. Well, guns are instruments. They don't have an inherently evil characteristic. That they are used by evil people to do evil things, there's no doubt about that. But they are also used by good people to do good things. So, the issue of instrumentality, you have to start with this reality. When you're talking about instrumentality, you're not talking about the attributes of the instrument. You're talking about who's using it. And that's one of the reasons Paul could say, and you know, any thoughtful believer would have to say with Paul, may it never be, or King James, God forbid, as the right answer, is the law sinful? No! Well, anybody that has any legitimate perception of God would have to say, no! But they might not know why. You just know that if God gave the law, there's nothing inherently evil in the law. It's just an instrument. But the whole issue here is that Paul is dealing with instrumentality, and the issue of instrumentality is the question of whether the instrument takes on the attributes of the user. And it's almost never the case. A most fundamental guiding principle in the scriptures is addressed by James in chapter 1 of the book when he says, God is not tempted by evil and he doesn't tempt any man with evil. Therefore, if the law came from God, it cannot be an instrument of temptation in terms of God's intention for law. He didn't intend for the law to be used as an instrument of temptation. That it was used that way only means that law has been twisted in terms of the divine intention. So, the answer is always going to be absolutely not. There's nothing sinful inherently in the law itself. But there is an answer in terms of, well, what is the real biblical divine function for law? And that's what the last half of the verse is involved in. That translation, on the contrary, is just three English words to translate one strong adversative in the Greek. It's a strong but as an alternative. No, there is no sinfulness in the law, but there is a legitimate biblical instrumentality for law. And that but is that there is a strong alternative to the suggestion that an instrument has taken on the attributes of its user. It has an inherent evil in it because its user is evil. There is an alternative to that suggestion, and the alternative is in the but statement. But, and Paul uses, in order for us to not get sidetracked, he uses exactly the same grammatical construction, through law, through law. I would not have come to know sin except through law. Now, what Paul is doing here is he's going to put forward God's actual intention in giving any form of law. Now, when we say any form, what we're talking about is, in Genesis chapter 3, don't eat the fruit of that tree. That's a form of law. It was never codified in terms of some kind of treaty deal or whatever like the Mosaic law was. The Mosaic law was an actual formal treaty between God and the people. And he made certain commitments to them, and he was demanding certain commitments from them. And that was a codified law, and that became the law. And it was the most perfect example or illustration or explanation of certain characteristics of God. Not all of them, because the law could not illustrate the mercy and compassion and grace attributes of God, because they're not there. The law is an expression of justice. It's an expression of the legitimacy of vengeance. It's the foundation for the expression of wrath. But there's no clear demonstration of grace in that. Now, there are some forms, for example, the sacrificial system, where if you did something wrong and you killed some animal and gave it as a sacrifice, that was supposed to take care of the wrong you did, but only at the level of illustration, because the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sin. It was simply an illustration of an available grace to come later. But that was some kind of a backdoor approach. The law is a justice instrument. And yet, in the justice issue, it means that God is going to use law for a specific reason, and rather than having to settle for the conclusion that there's something flawed in the law, that it's sinful, he's going to argue for a strong alternative. And his strong alternative is that we have to draw a conclusion that, number one, evil passions are through law. Number two, that does not make the law sinful. Absolutely not. That is the false conclusion. Don't draw it. But we have to draw one. So what do we draw? Well, it starts with Paul's statement, I would not have come to know. And this is extremely important, because what he's saying here is knowing is a legitimate expression of God's intention for giving law. Knowing is crucial. You have to recognize some things in order to move along. You can't grow from this point to that point without drawing legitimate conclusions. And so, in order to draw them, you have to know some things, and it becomes necessary to know in order to recognize. And the getting to the point of recognizing, in this text, I would not have come to know sin. I would not have come to know the sin. I would not have come to know the impact that the sin is having on me in producing sins, if there had never been a law given, because I would not have known about coveting, he says, if there had not been a law that said, you shall not do that. So one of the first things he's saying is that you have to recognize some things, and the law was given to give this recognition. Now, in the recognition thing, he's talking about coming to know sin. And I think that's at this point that Romans 5:13 takes center stage. Because in Romans 5, Paul is arguing about how through one man, verse 12, sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and death spread to all men because all sinned. In verse 13 it says, until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there's no law. Nevertheless, death reigned. Now what he means by that is this. As long as there is no law, there is no imputation of sinfulness. But that doesn't mean that sin isn't present, and it doesn't mean that the behavior isn't sinful. It just means there's no imputation of it. Remember chapter 4, where it says, verse 8, blessed is the man whose sin the Lord will not take into account. He will not impute it. Well, is it sin? Yeah. Does God impute it? No. Why? Well, partly because the law's been taken out of the picture, and when there's no law, there's no imputation of sin. But I want you to notice what verse 13, chapter 5, and verse 14 is actually saying. It says, when there's no law, sin is not imputed. But it doesn't say, when there's no law, sin doesn't have any impact. He actually says in verse 14, sin does its damage in spite of the fact that it's not imputed to the person. Well, isn't that what we studied in chapter 6? We are now in Christ. God is not imputing any acts of sin to us, even though we commit sins on a regular basis. Does that mean then that we're free to sin because God is not reckoning our sin to it? He's not imputing it to us? No. He said, shall we sin because we're under grace? No. Why? Because sin still has its impact. If you sin, you're going to suffer the consequences of that sin in the repercussions of action and reaction. You sow it, you reap it. Well, Romans 5 says point blankly, if there's no law, there's no imputation, but it does not say, if there's no law, there's no consequences. In fact, I think in Genesis 3, where God says, don't eat of the fruit of that tree, he instituted the principle of law as a revelation, and some people get all offended because God put a tree in the garden, and if he hadn't put the tree there, then there wouldn't have been any possibility of men sinning. Well, that's not true. There had been an angelic rebellion in heaven. There was no apparent law given to the angels, but sin erupted, and it caused an enormous conflict in the angelic realm, and a third of the angels followed the lead of the principal sinner. And he was loose in God's creation. So even if the tree hadn't been there, he would have come into the garden. And he would have done something to try to seduce Adam and Eve into his way of behaving. And even if they hadn't known, he would have still been doing that. And so what God did was he gave a revelation that was just point blank, inescapably clear. You eat that fruit, you will die. What's unclear about that? So the issue is, clarity. The law was given for revelatory purpose. It was given to make something clear. Well, in Paul's illustration, he says, I would not have come to know sin. I would have been subject to all of the consequences of the behavior that was sinful, and I would have been a victim of all other people's sins, even though there was no law. We would have been living in this miserable situation, but it would not have been imputed to us because there was no clarity. So why do we need clarity? For imputation's sake? No, for understanding's sake. Paul says, I was a covetous person. I coveted and coveted and coveted and coveted, but I would have never been able to identify my behavior as wrong if there had never been a law given that said, you don't do that. Don't do that. And I really believe that he uses the coveting, which is actually the translation is lusting. You shall not covet means you shall not lust. The word is epithumia. It means to have a strong, potent desire for something. Well, I wouldn't have known that having these potent, strong desires was wrong if God hadn't revealed to me that it was wrong. And he made it very clear that it was wrong. You shall not lust. Well, there are all kinds of consequences from that statement, but the first consequence is clarity. All of a sudden, I know that lusting's wrong. How I deal with that, that's a whole different issue, because we're going to see that as we go through the rest of the chapter. But the fact is, Romans 5:13 says, sin is not imputed when there's no law, but verse 14 says, but it still has its impact in your experience. So if you sin, you suffer the consequences, which are death, even if you don't know what you're doing. So sin's presence in the world is essentially destructive, and it was already in the creation before God ever created man. And when he put him in the garden, sin was going to be injected into that situation, because there was already a hateful antagonist of God who was going to do what he could to bring humanity into the mix on his side. So the consequences are going to run. And that's the second half of chapter 6's argument. You don't want to sin because you're not under law, simply because you're still going to suffer the consequences. You don't want to have to suffer those consequences, so don't get involved in that. Well, in order to escape the consequences, you have to understand the root. And the root is explained by law. The law is what said sin produces agendas in the body and in the soul and in the spirit that are contrary to one another, and they all argue and fight with one another, and this is where the conflict of sin is developed. And it's sin that's causing that. And you have to understand that in order to go to the next step. So, we have to decide that the law is not sinful in itself, that it's revelatory, but not regulatory. It was given to reveal, but it wasn't given to regulate, because you can't regulate sin with law. In fact, verse 8 says, apart from law, sin's dead. So, if you don't have law, then you don't have to have regulation. The problem with that is, without knowledge, sin's going to still have its impact in its deceptive capacities. So you have to know. And he says that law was the revealer. God's intention for law was never to regulate behavior. It was clearly to draw a clear line in the sand between what is right and what is wrong. Law says, don't lust. So every time you lust, you know you're violating law. So the sinful problem is the inner lusts that are in conflict with one another. And I actually believe that that's the reason why he uses the coveting. The law, you shall not covet, is only one of several that he could have chosen from. But his illustration is already in verse 5, the sinful passions that are in the body and the soul and the spirit. And these have to do with covetousness. They have to do with lusting after their own agenda. So, the sinful problem is the inner lusts in conflict with one another. And the law's solution is to say something that's wrong. You shall not do that. And by saying that, it makes very clear what's right, what's wrong. And as soon as this saying occurs, you're immediately aware that this behavior's faulty. You shall not lust means every time you lust, you're out of line. And that's the beginning. That beginning means revelation has begun. Clarity has started to settle in. And that's the whole point of law, is to bring clarity. It was never designed to bring us to salvation except indirectly, because the clarity of law is firmly fixed by Paul, chapter 3, when he said, the law speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth will be closed and all the world may become accountable. Revelation is the function of law, and the problem with the revelation that God gives is, as soon as it's revealed, condemnation is a very real possibility. And that's where sin begins to manipulate. If there is a standard, and God declares this standard to be the case, then the accuser will say, that's the kind of God you've got. He doesn't want you to have a good time. He doesn't want you to have life. He wants you to regulate. He wants to dominate. He wants to control. And they use all these words to try to influence us in our capital T theology to start thinking of God as some kind of an ogre. That's the whole point of the use of the law. But we'll get into that next time. The point is this evening, two issues. One is, you do have to draw conclusions. You can't grow but without those. And the second one is the conclusion we draw about law is that it was for revelation so that we could be clear on exactly what the issues are. And as was pointed out in the discussion time afterwards last week, the whole issue of law is to simply reveal what's not of the Spirit of God, so that we can then judge whether we're walking by faith and the Spirit of God's controlling or not, because the law's pretty clear. And in that clarity, we have then a basis for operating by faith. So, we'll quit there.